All right. Good morning. So we're going to switch gears from outcomes to implementation analysis. And I just wanted to queue up my time because I have a tendency to talk fast and a lot. Okay. So again, I wanted to put the authors down here to remind you what a large team we represent. And again, I'm Deborah Lehman. I have no relationships to disclose. And my job today is really to talk about what we learned during the implementation process and how we learned it. So in brief, to really talk about the how we assess the implementation of a dialogic approach, how we identified barriers and solutions, and how we designed a real-time feedback loop. So our main mechanism really was we tried to develop an evaluation that aligned with this innovative model. And so I want to explain a background of why I'm saying it's innovative. So Parachute NYC was the first large-scale urban implementation of dialogic practice in the U.S. And as Mary Jane mentioned, only second internationally. So we're joining Germany in this effort. It's the single largest effort to date anywhere to integrate peers into the public mental health system. So none of these individual parts are brand new. Crisis respites aren't brand new. Dialogism is not new. Peer support's not new. The difference was the massive effort to combine all of these with these models that Mary Jane Alexander mentioned and launch this in the public mental health system. That was quite new. And that effort, there was no mentors, there was no colleagues, there was no roadmap for individuals to kind of anticipate what was going to be coming next, what were going to be some of the challenges. So there were a lot of experts in these different silos, but just no one to rely on, okay, so what do we do when we're integrating peers at the same time that we're trying to convert our mobile crisis teams? And so with that, the City of New York, DOHMH, invested funds for this intensive local evaluation. So to weather this unknown, this group assembled and deployed this evaluation. And I want to mention that the Center for Medicare and Medicaid did not invest. It was the last minute that they said that they removed local evaluation funding. So this was an additional investment provided by the city. So a little bit more about the why and the how. So I mentioned some literature here. Our main goal was to, again, align with this innovation to really make sure that we complemented what was going on and not intrude. So we really wanted to foster an evaluation that would allow for continuous adaptation. This required a lot of invisible work across all parties involved, trainers, the city, the mobile teams, the respite centers. And we don't want evaluation to hinder that. We wanted to really actually support it. So it was really important for us to create an evaluation that fostered that. So we built a very ethnographically intense track and report mechanism. So how it worked, how we did that. You know, all evaluation has relationships. There's more traditional impact evaluation where you have more objectivity and separation. But most of the time, when you work with your evaluators, my experience has been that there is a quite intense relationship. But this evaluation was quite different. The intimacy, the intensity of this ethnographic work was unique. So these are three kind of areas which I think kind of highlight how intimate our methodology was. We were there with these teams, with these respite center staff, early and often. So very first day of training, there was field staff sitting alongside clinicians learning about these models. And these trainings were quite intensive. The number of hours they put in and the long days, none of this was didactic. It was very interactive. And it required quite a bit of yourself. So you were doing role plays. You were talking about actual real life scenarios. And we as the field staff, I'm pointing to Judy because she and I were constantly in the field together. But actually everyone here from Pablo Sadler, David Lindy, they all at some point went to a training to observe what these models were. And I think that really launched that trust building and relationship we had with the providers. And that allowed us to be kind of this pestering source, hanging out always, shadowing these teams. And so we were there often. I want to say that relationship, they were really welcoming. They were very patient with us because we were there all the time. And then finally, I want to mention that the HQ interviews that Dr. Alexander discussed, She mentioned how that was coordinated with the teams. This was also a tight relationship. They really allowed us kind of open that gate of when we would approach, they would recruit first, then we would contact the participants. This is both the respites and the mobile teams. We really wanted to make sure we didn't intrude on that treatment process. And we aligned that evaluation. They went through a lot of these questions, but we didn't do it in an assessor kind of way. We sat side by side in their homes or at in the community. And they saw everything. They punched every button or told their story sitting right next to us. So we really tried again to complement that intervention. And that work, going into their homes, meeting the families, hearing their stories, that allowed us to kind of experience both that price of that work, you know, doors shoved in our face, or as well as the privilege of hearing these stories of recovery. And I think that along with hearing supervision, shadowing the teams, gave us a 360 view, and also just allowed us kind of that extra connection with the teams that built different trust, a different level of connection. So when we think really about evaluation theory, when we look at our evaluation, we really feel like it best aligns with developmental evaluation. And for that reason, I wanted to put this quote up by Michael Quinn Patton. Developmental programming calls for developmental evaluation, in which the evaluator becomes part of the design team, helping to monitor what's happening, both processes and outcomes, in an evolving, rapidly changing environment of constant feedback and change. And I think that really captures what we tried to do. So here is all of what we did task-wise. I won't go through all of them, but I mentioned being a part of training. There was about 112 days. We attended staff meetings. We went to supervision meetings. We did over 60 key informant interviews. We shadowed teams. We witnessed actual network meetings where the treatment intervention with open dialogue. We conducted focus groups. We did narrative interviews with some of the young men experiencing their first episode. And we also helped through 28 meetings develop a training curriculum. I'm going to refer to that as the train the trainer model that helped kind of foster a connection across the boroughs as well as support future training efforts over time for replication. So all of that observation of hanging around, being with these teams, being at these respites led to 24 what we're calling dispatches. These were short, rapid memos that we wrote quickly that would be to the City of New York DOHMH. Often it would include relevant folks like the trainers. Whatever we saw on the front lines that kind of needed attention, what we were observing, we would shoot that off. And then sometimes there'd be an issue that needed a little bit more attention. So we did 11 thematic summaries, longer memos. We did some extended reports regarding training and implementation. We did a longer report on just the difficulty of NYC's cultural mix. And then we did a longer white paper about the origins and implementation of Parachute. So what I'm going to talk about are only about four of the main implementation issues that I feel like this approach and our work really kind of, it's highlighted there. We have quite a long report about all of our implementation findings, and although I could talk for days, I won't. And I'm also skipping issues regarding peer integration because Judy Sugarman's going to highlight a lot of that. So in those four areas, I want to just chat a little bit about what we observed, how really that issue was addressed, managed, and what we think may be lessons for future replication efforts. So, training. This was quite a massive effort. Mary Jane Alexander mentioned the two models. There was a third called Peer Health Navigation. Everyone involved in this effort were constantly in training. And it's pretty normal that when you have a new program that you might have, you know, here's your motivational interviewing or here's your dialogue. And what we noticed was it was launched that way. Here was peer support, here was your dialogism. And since we were at the front lines, we could see that there was all these gaps where trainees really didn't understand how that fit with their job and their responsibilities, or how these models were so complementary, but what about these areas that they didn't fully match? IPS really talked about a didactic relationship, while this open dialogue stuff is all network-based. And so what we found was that we really couldn't do this training in full silos, that we needed to find ways to bridge these for the trainees. And so part of our role was brokering that relationship between the trainees. And we were so lucky to have such willing, able experts who provided IPS, Peer Health Navigation, and the NATM Open Dialogue that they were ready to roll up their sleeves and talk about ways in which they connect. We also worked with DOHMH to provide additional orientation sessions that were separate from the kind of skill-based training that allowed people time to just ask about their job. Like, what do we do with transportation problems and some operational issues? Moving on. So another large implementation issue was a lack of a community of practice. So I mentioned that we were really lucky to have so many experts in all of these different areas. But what we didn't have is someone who had done parachute locally. So even though we had people from Finland who came all the way over to kind of give us experience about what Parachute Sweden looked like, no one had done this work in New York City. And that can be tough when you're doing this work for the first time. And so we saw really that loss, that gap of not being able to go to a colleague and talk about a particular case. What would you do? How would you handle this issue? Someone's coming in the respite, they were supposed to only have people who were stably housed. They lost their housing while we're here. What do we do? And so we kind of noticed that gap. And through our work, through our relationship with the providers in DOHMH, we try to create more opportunities for that community of practice. We found that the train-the-trainer model was one of the few areas where individuals who were working across the boroughs had a chance to really think through their skills and create relationships across their little teams. And we just want to say to future efforts that we find that the amount of resources that takes and the stubbornness it takes is something to think about and plan for in the future. Operational issues. So I put this as third. But it's big. It's all of the daily things that people ask about to their supervisor, and it can really impact your job. Things like trying to get from Coney Island in Brooklyn all the way up to Williamsburg and do these 90-minute meetings. And so we would hear all of these different challenges. And our relationship that was built, I believe, on a lot of trust, is that we got to be a sounding board. We got to sit there or listen to supervision and get really what people are frustrated with. And also just serve as an ear to when people needed to talk through what was making their job so hard. And that was important to us because this is work that requires a lot of yourself. You're going into these homes, you're listening to people's story, and it's quite a privilege. And that needs to be as easy as possible for the frontline staff. So we tried to kind of serve as that sounding board and then reflect that back to DOHMH, escalate what issues, whatever they can feasibly address. One of the ones that we felt like we were able to address is that the trainers, a lot of the frontline mobile crisis team staff felt this one-year limitation based on a promise to CMS makes a lot of sense when it comes to delivering cost savings. Wasn't working when it comes to really clinical work, not for every client. And so through a lot of discussions between that came up during meetings and then through a dispatch process, this was identified, and ultimately DOHMH decided that that decision needs to be at the discretion of the clinical teams. So it's just one example of a way in which that relationship, that feedback mechanism, worked and changed and was a part of fueling the program architects' innovation and strategic kind of creative problem solving throughout these 3 years. So the lessons we have, one is pretty concrete. Before you start, try as best as you can to do your comprehensive and flexible data management system. Invest in some dedicated feedback loops. And then last is one that I haven't mentioned, but that the frontline staffs really struggled often with these other system barriers. They had someone engaged, this work is purposely not coercive, and suddenly the person is arrested, they're involved in the criminal justice system. Those system barriers became quite difficult. So the other lesson that we really learned was about how to negotiate these recovery-focused connections with multiple systems. One of the last big areas that I wanted to talk about is the tension that builds as you age, as you mature in an innovative project. There's a point when kind of the innovation slows down, you get more comfortable, and you start to care about the skill and the quality and moving from innovation to model fidelity, especially when you also are thinking about trying to do a more rigorous impact evaluation. So this tension was coming up as it matured, and so it's something that the team that we were observing on the front lines kind of early, and you know, really trying to tease out what are the core components of what is Parachute, what is important, what is adaptive. Every borough did it a little differently. Everyone had their own flavor. Every community was a bit different. So the team at NKI, along with frontline staff, facilitated again the train the trainers, which really, that process facilitated that reflection on what are the core components and what needed to be promoted for replication. So our lessons are, the top one is a bit naive, but still hopeful. In the perfect ideal world, you would be able to delay a rigorous impact evaluation for a couple of years. You've got to get a time to really kind of gel and before you really start trying to measure those outcomes. But I know that is not always possible when you have funders looking for those outcomes. And then finally, we wanted to invest in cultivating moments of reflection and thought. What really are the principles of these models? And how are you able to really use the expertise of the individuals who have been doing this work to feedback on, for our New York City context, for our urban area, what really were the core principles, and move from there. So what needs further work? I would say, I think Pablo Sadler would agree, that at times, maybe the evaluation team was too quiet, maybe we could have banged on the door a little bit more, that there are just certain areas or certain points here I wanted to bring up that we still think need further work that we observed during our implementation ethnographic work. And the top one is what you saw already from the outcome analysis, that these were two separate projects happening simultaneously. That wasn't the original design, but that's what happened in real life. And so we feel like we didn't fully foster or broker that relationship between the teams and the respite centers. We still think there's a lot of work to create a community of practice. Having a colleague to call, having someone to call and rely on and discuss cases, frustrations, celebrate successes, that's invaluable. And the last is that these individuals who experience this, people come to their homes, they get peer support. This is really novel. And there's a point when the team may go away. And then that handoff to maybe a traditional or a different outpatient provider, that could be quite jarring if it doesn't complement or there's not what we're calling parachute-friendly providers. And so another area which we think kind of needs further work is really making sure that that handoff, those providers, that won't be such a, won't be a rude awakening, that they'll be able to still access peer support, access dialogic psychotherapy, even when the team may no longer be there. A fourth one is we notice a lot of these young men were without a GED, without a job, and they had nothing to do all day, and really limited opportunities to really seek after vocational work and educational opportunities. So that's just another area we would think in the future to look at. And then finally, New York City has, for many years, and many other urban areas, has an affordable housing crisis. Nothing new. It does feel a little bit more critical at the moment. But trying to think even more creatively, it's definitely an issue that the providers would elevate to us constantly, is that housing is a problem. So that's what I have about implementation. One other area that is such a key core of the implementation is peer support, and Judy Sugarman's going to discuss that.